When it comes to compact construction equipment, Takuchi is a globally trusted brand. The famous red and grey machines you see everywhere are built to perform on any site, delivering power, precision, comfort and reliability from 1 to 15 tons. Now offering a lineup of proven compact track loaders, versatile tool carriers for construction and highways. Choose machines that work as hard as you do. Visit Takuchi-mfg.co.uk to find out more.
It's Wednesday, the 29th of October, 2025, and this is Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, reviewing some of the news from the past fortnight. And I know you've got some news, Phil, because although you don't get out very often, you went to the pictures last night.
I did. Not just any old pictures. I went to BAFTA, the British Academy of Film and Television Arts, in Piccadilly. Which is very exciting. Never been there before, and it was a very grand occasion. And the reason why I went was at the invitation of Gilbert Ash, somewhat surprisingly, the Northern Ireland-based building contractor, who have commissioned the production of a film, a documentary, 45 minutes long, I suppose, called Building Culture, about five of their recent-ish, going back to 2011 was the oldest project completed. But over a period of 12 years, basically, they had a purple patch of five. All five of these projects were either Stirling Prize, which is a big architecture prize, Stirling Prize nominated or shortlisted, or in one case, they won the Stirling Prize. And actually, I think if you're going to pick one of those for the Stirling Prize, I would have picked one of the other ones, which to me was outstanding. And I knew absolutely nothing about it. So I'll start off with my takeaways from the event before talking about some of the projects. Just talk briefly, because it's all history now rather than news. But I came away thinking, what a fabulous company Gilbert Ash is. I mean, the projects showcased in this film, this documentary, were all rather fabulous. A lot of highly architectural, you know, star architects involved. And
I was going to say, presumably buildings. the architects come away with a bit of glory as well, not just a contractor.
Well, the point is that the running theme was the architects sort of drew a bitty picture, and Gilbert Ash had to, like, you know, do the drawings and work out how to make it work. And in some cases came up with substantial or significant, I should say, architectural detail themselves.
Oh, right, okay.
So, I mean, they're really, and a theme throughout was the close relations. Normally when an architect works on, walks on site and, you know, turns up, the contractor kind of goes, oh God, what's he or she doing here, you know? Yeah. In this case, it's, hey, yeah, come on, come see what we're doing. This is great, we're really loving this. And there just seems to be okay, this is a promotional film. They would say that, wouldn't they? But I bought it, that they seem to have really good relations with the client, the team, and the supply chain. And I just came away thinking, this is a good company. They do things well. And if I was going to do some fancy posh building, I would certainly trust them.
Do they only do fancy posh buildings, or do they do? I mean, I had a quick look on their website, and they do some overseas stuff as well. They did a rather interesting building in Tbilisi, which is, what's that, the capital of Albania? Is it? I can't remember.
No, it's not Albania, but it's one of those ones over there.
Yeah, but that caught my eye. I mean, quite an interesting building as well. Do they do the sheds and all that sort of?
They don't do sheds. I also had a quick look on their website. I mean, my eye was obviously diverted by the glamorous projects, cool. But they certainly do, you know, school buildings and that sort of thing. But they tend to be, I mean, you know, maybe public school buildings or school buildings which have got a little bit more, you know, thought. They don't appear to do the cookie cutter stuff. They do stuff where they can do stuff where they can add value, and they don't. I mean, maybe this is where they will or hope to be heading, but they don't seem to be doing the really big stuff. It's more like sort of, you know, your McAlpines who will do the, you know, House of Parliament or Buckingham Palace kind of
yeah,
jobs.
Yeah.
They're hotspot. I mean, of the five projects, I'll just briefly run through them. The contract value or the project value ranged from 10 million to 32 million. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's substantial jobs, but not huge. And in order of completion, the five projects that featured in the film, most of them I knew nothing about, I am ashamed to say. So it was an education for me entirely. The Lyric Theatre in Belfast, the Giant's Causeway Visitor Centre on the Northampton coast in Northern Ireland.
I didn't know they had a visitor centre. Well, I suppose they didn't. Well,
they did have one. It burnt down in 25 years ago or something.
Okay.
So they for £10 million, they put up a new one. But you can't really see it. It's one of those things where, you know, you drive up in the car park and it's all covered over.
Blended into the landscape sort of thing.
Exactly, yes.
Oh, right, okay.
And rather beautifully done with sort of, I was going to say granite, certainly stone pillars along one side, which rather wonderfully is made out of the same basalt stone that the Giant's Causeway itself is made out of. The third project that features in the film is the Everyman Theatre in Liverpool, and that's the one that won the Stirling Prize.
Oh,
and
okay.
it's rather fabulous. And the I don't know whether she was the MD or the client person from the Everyman Theatre was there at this event, and there's a Q&A afterwards, and she was saying that, you know, a lot of the people in Liverpool and in the area were horrified at the idea of their Everyman Theatre was being knocked down. So, why are you knocking down our theatre? And they had to do quite a bit of, you know, outreach work to persuade people that while you may love what's going on the stage in the Everyman Theatre, you should see what's going on backstage and how crummy it is. And this is what, you know, why we're doing it, what we're doing. And when it opened, you know, it's obviously a big source of pride again, and more mm-hmm. so for the city. The fourth one, which is the one which I was most wowed by, was the, again, never heard of it, Cambridge Central Mosque, which was completed in 2019.
Oh,
this
right.
is a Mark Sparfield, who are top architects, on their project.
Okay.
I mean, what made it look so, or what makes it look so striking, I mean, it really is an innovative design, which looks like something you might only see in sort of, you know, Saudi Arabia, Istanbul or something. Within it, I don't know how many, but the key feature is these glue laminated timber wooden trees looking like sort of upturned, you know, in an umbrella goes upside down in the wind.
If you imagine
that, but with the cloth of the umbrella ripped out. But these basically, you know, glue lam trees, huge things. As supporting the roof structure, and it just looks fabulous. A dome that you'd like to see on a mosque, but not as intrusive as what you might see in Istanbul or whatever. I keep referring to Istanbul because I went there earlier this year and visited a couple
yes.
of the mosques. And to be honest, certainly on the inside, this building was, I think, judging by from this film, as fabulous as anything you'd find anywhere. So a beautiful building. And the man who was instrumental in getting the thing off the ground, or, you know, chairing the committee, I'm sure there are lots of people who are instrumental, but he was there as well talking about it. And it's become a huge thing in Cambridge. This he says there's a four-month waiting list for guided tours. They do guided tours for
good
visitors.
Gracious, really?
Four-month waiting list just to look around this mosque. Which is quite a thing. So I do.
Presumably, if you're a Muslim, you can get in straight away.
I imagine if you're worshiping or yeah, but you know, to get into the grand mosques in Istanbul, I think I only had to wait about 20 minutes. I mean, it's a huge queue in the morning, but I went in the afternoon. You know, I don't think I even waited 20 minutes. So, Cambridge Central Mosque, built by Gilbert Ash, sensational. And finally, a project that I was familiar with, although I still haven't been inside the building, is the National Portrait Gallery, which finished just in 2023, 32 million job. And the architect of that job, Jamie Fobert, he was there as well, and it was quite interesting hearing him, his take on Gilbert Ash. And so we had, you know, client or two clients and an architect from these various projects, all singing the praises of Gilbert Ash. And I just thought, I wonder how much of their marketing budget has that. Yes. Well, first of all, I wonder what their marketing budget is, Gilbert Ash, and how much has gone on this film and this event. But it's the various clients there spoke to people and said, oh, what are you doing with Gilbert Ash? So, well, you know, we're not, but we're pitching for a job with them, and we hope to be working with them. Another person says, we haven't yet, but, you know, we're looking to. So I think the aim of the event, it's always nice to have, you know, people like, you know, me and commentators saying they seem like a good bunch. Much more important for clients or potential project partners to say, yeah, you know, we've been won over by what we've seen. So from a marketing point of view, and I think this is going to become a bit of a theme of our conversation this morning, David,
yeah,
marketing,
as we walk
through it. It was, win-win.
Wow. Well, I mean, yeah, it's... I was going to ask you why they decided to sort of go big on this and why now? I mean, hiring BAFTA. I didn't know that BAFTA was a place. I thought it was just a prize. And, you know, a big event in central London. And presumably it didn't, you know, it probably cost them a fair amount of money to have the film made in the first place. But I suppose they thought the time was right and that, you know, obviously no publicity is bad publicity. So if they put on a show like this in central London, presumably it's going to drum up quite a lot of business. I mean, I'm aware of Gilbert Ash. I recognise the name. I couldn't have even told you that they were based in Belfast until I actually got the information about this event. So, you know, it has raised their profile, I'm sure.
But I don't think it would be prohibitively expensive, the film itself, to be fair, because it was comprised of talking heads and, you know, when you do... PowerPoint things with photos from, you know, during construction and, you know, sort of phasing in and, you know, sliding in and sliding out kind of thing. So it's the sort of thing you or I could do ourselves with, you know, PowerPoint and pointing it at talking heads. That's not to do it down. It was very well done. Congratulations to them who did it. But what I mean is that any other construction company who's, you know, proud of their work shouldn't think, well, I couldn't afford to get Spielberg to come and make, you know, an E.T. yeah, type quite. Film of a. You don't need to. You can do something really, really good and creative quite simply.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I know that we want to discuss something quite different, but again, it is about raising one's profile and getting a message out there to the general public. I mean, being mentioned in Parliament is usually a good way of raising awareness, because if, you know, you've got MPs sitting on either side of the house and you are cited or your message is being put across to the people who basically run the country, in other words, that's clearly very good. And in fact, the cement industry got a bit of publicity in that respect, didn't they, the other day, when one of their, what I think is actually a really good initiative, was discussed in the House in a debate. It was an adjournment debate. I don't know what an adjournment debate is.
Adjournment debates are typically not very well attended. They tend to be the last event of the day. I mean, sometimes when they're voting on legislation, you know, the House of Business can go on quite late into the night, although much less so these days than it used to. But it was, you know, back end of the afternoon. And it was an MP called John Whitby, who's the Labour MP for Derbyshire Dales, who has in his constituency the Hope Cement Works, which is now owned by Breedon. It's the UK's largest cement works. And that cement works is involved in something called the Peak Cluster Cement Decarbonisation Project, which is it's connecting carbon capture sites in Derbyshire and Staffordshire and Cheshire to a carbon storage location on the Wirral. So it's all about, you know, a big part of it is decarbonising cement production. And there is a commercial blockage. The whole thing can only come alive, or they, you know, one thing they're looking for is for the government to say, yes, we will buy the energy which comes from this, we will buy for, you know, like what they call the strike price, like they said to EDF, Hinkley and whatever, and some sort of commitment from government. And that was one of the things. It's basically it's is the debate was on, the topic was on the decarbonization of cement.
Yeah.
And it wasn't at, it was barely attended. I mean, it was virtually empty chamber.
John, there were three MPs sitting on the benches, weren't there? Something like that.
Well, John Whitby was the MP for cement for Hope Works. So he spoke for whatever 15 minutes talking about what basically the cement, you know, what's been, mm-hmm. what Hope are doing, sorry, what Beedon are doing, and what they want to happen with this peak cluster cement project. There was the minister responsible for that, who has to reply for the government and say, you know, thank you, and this is what we're doing. Sitting behind the minister, right behind, so if there were anyone watching on TV, it looked like there was someone else there. Was an MP. I've no idea who she was, but she was passing him notes and slipping out and passing him notes. So I assume she was his PPS and was there just sort of to support him. And there was one lone Tory on the opposition front bench. No idea who it was, but I assume it was the industry minister's opposite number.
And that was somebody who just fell asleep and forgotten to get up and go home.
I think it's element of duty. If you're a shadow minister and your minister's in the house, you have to sit there and shadow them. They didn't take part or join the discussion or anything. But what I thought was interesting, the first time I've seen, he's actually Minister for Construction, this guy, Chris McDonald. Mm. The first time I've seen him in action in Parliament. He was elected last year for, where's his seat? I'm not sure where his seat is, actually. I think it's somewhere in the northeast. But he previously, until last year, was chief executive of the Materials Processing Institute.
Mm.
Which, here we go, Stockton North, yes, northeast. He was elected MP for Stockton North last year. He spent 10 years as chief executive of the Materials Processing Institute.
Which I've never heard of.
Well, it's a spin-off from Tata. It used to be Tata Steel, or British Steel, sort of...
Oh, I see, yes.
Okay. Labs or something. And it was Tata Steel spun it off. So he obviously knows about, you know, construction materials and all issues, particularly steel and cement and concrete and so on. So he knows his stuff and he knows about the construction industry. And as luck would have it, unusually, it's unusual to get someone who knows what they're talking about. If you listen to Rory Stewart, when he was a Tory minister, he was sent to the Foreign Office, oh, fantastic, I'm an expert on the Middle East. I'm going to get the Middle East. And he got Africa, which he knew absolutely nothing about. So why can't I have what I'm an expert on? He said, no, it doesn't work like that. You have to get something you know nothing about so that civil servants can control you, basically. but for once we have, and Chris McDonald, he's got more than two jobs, but he's in two different departments. He's a minister in the Department for Energy and Energy Security and Net Zero, and is in the Department for Business and Trade, as Minister for Industry. And within that, he's also the Construction Minister. So he's the government side co-chair of the Construction Industry Council. So it's... And he demonstrated. He started off saying, "Well, I don't really want to give a lecture on cement and the chemistry of cement," and then dived into precisely that. Wasn't that long, but he certainly okay. I'm probably reading it, and anyone can read it. But it was just good to have someone who seemed to be well on top of his brief. I'm not sure he actually promised us anything that the cement lobby has been pushing for, though. I don't know if you remember back in March, David, you and I talked about the Mineral Products Association, their sort of lobby push, saying that they're very upset that there was a timber strategy that the government had produced.
And a steel strategy.
And there was a steel industry strategy that the government had produced, and this, that and the other, but nothing for cement or concrete. Mm. And the quarrying sector are terribly put out that the whole planning and infrastructure bill that's going through, all this stuff about fast-tracking housing, making planning more simple and removing the blockages and obstacles from planning, but nothing about removing the blocks from quarry planning applications, because we've got the reserves are decades ahead, but they're being depleted and they're not being filled up as fast as they should be, the consented quarries and so on. So I don't think If I was the Mineral Products Association, I'd think, yay, great debate in Parliament. Oh dear, no one was there.
Yeah.
Great, the minister, you know, knows what he's talking about and he knows what we want and what we need. Oh dear, he's not actually, you know, promising too much. So it's like sort of good news, bad news, in a way.
Well, it is a shame it didn't get more more attention. I mean, I think it's fairly ironic, actually, because one of our political preoccupations at the moment is, of course, net zero and the need to decarbonise. And surely everybody by now knows that the global cement industry is responsible for, I think it's 8% of man-made carbon emissions around the world. So it's the biggest single source of carbon emissions. Man-made carbon emissions. And so, you know, if we're going to be serious about reducing our carbon footprint, surely we've got to do something about cement production. And I think this idea of capturing carbon, I think if I got it right, what they're going to do is extract the carbon dioxide and then pipe it to these carbon storage facilities in various different parts of the north of England. I mean, it's one solution. Sounds like quite a good solution to me. And I think probably we ought to be taking it more seriously. And I think he did make also some remarks about, who was it, John Whitby, talking about how we ought to really promote domestic production of cement in this country because we're serious about reducing our carbon footprint. And if we were to implement some of these ideas, particularly this idea about carbon reduction in the sector, we could do a lot by making it ourselves rather than importing it from countries that obviously don't really do much to reduce their carbon footprint. So I think it's a potentially big contribution to carbon reduction if we're serious about that. And if we are serious about it, we should have been paying attention. Well, you know, you and I were aware of it, but that's because it's our job. I don't know how many other people really noticed this debate and whether it got any sort of wider publicity.
But there's been a general trend over the years that the press does not really report on Parliament very much anymore. They still have their lobby correspondents in the House, but in you know, 20, 30 years ago, all the big newspapers would have a full, you know, and when they were big, you know, full-sized rather than tabloids, which they all are now, almost all are now, they would have a full page or sometimes two pages every day of what happened in Parliament yesterday.
Yeah.
And
this
might not get much, but there'd be a paragraph saying there was a, you know, debate on this topic.
It doesn't happen now.
Apart from the pantomime of Prime Minister's questions, which even that isn't that well observed anymore, the actual workings of Parliament don't really get much press.
No, it's a shame. It is a shame. Well, I think that's an interesting story, actually. Not the fact that there was nobody in Parliament to hear it, but what was said in Parliament. I'll take a closer look at that, and I think there could be some stories in there for us, actually, Phil. So, you know, it's worth paying attention. But there are other ways of getting publicity and making the public sit up and take notice, aren't there? You know what we're coming on to.
I know what you're getting into. How to, you know.
Well, I mean,
there's
one particularly juicy marketing story that we will discuss. But there was another one which you posted last week, which I thought was also interesting, and it was a rebranding exercise. And we talked about rebranding in the past within the construction industry and whether or not it's a good idea, a bad idea, whether it backfires or whether it actually makes a positive difference. And this was Hitachi Construction Machinery. I mean, everybody knows about Hitachi. I think it's the fourth biggest Japanese conglomerate. They make everything from rolling stock for railways through to They used to make hi-fis. They used to have one. But nuclear reactors and stuff like that, they make everything, you know, like these big Japanese companies are famed for. But they've decided to rename themselves. They're not going to be Hitachi Construction Machinery anymore. They're going to call themselves Landcross, which sounds a little bit like a Land Rover ripoff, what you might see on the bonnet of a Chinese all-terrain vehicle. Landcross, L-A-N-D-C-R-O-S, just one S.
Yeah, it does sound like a bad Chinese ripoff, doesn't it?
It does a bit. Is that a Land Rover? No, it's a Landcross. Okay, fair enough. But I'm always fascinated to read about the thinking behind these rebranding exercises. And, you know, traditionally, I don't know whether they did employ some brand consultant at great expense in order to come up with this new name. Have they got a new logo? I don't know. What surprised me actually was that they dropped the Hitachi logo, which I recognised and hadn't been aware that they'd dropped it several years ago. But yeah, they've rebranded, or they are rebranding as Landcross. They're going to phase it in, I think, over an 18-month period. And in fact, there was a statement in your story which caught my eye. It was from the Hitachi Construction Machinery president, Masafumi Senzaki, who said, "We aim to cultivate Landcross into a brand that will make our customers feel that they have made the right choice when selecting our machinery or services, our shareholders confident about their decision to invest in the company, and our employees feel that their work is meaningful." He thinks he's going to achieve all that by changing the name, which I find is a bit of a stretch, don't you?
Well, this is just marketing speak and brand speak.
I think it's what they call manifesting, you know?
Well,
you've heard about manifesting. Yeah. If you believe that something's going to happen, then that's enough to make it happen. And I think they believe that this new brand has the power to transform the business and reinvigorate it. That seems to be the thinking behind it.
I think they'd invigorate it more if they called it Apple or Sony or something which had an even bigger brand value than Hitachi had. I mean,
there might be some copyright issues associated with that.
No, of course.
That.
But my point is that they've got a really strong, powerful brand which has got, you know, good, positive feelings in the market, I think. I mean, I haven't owned Hitachi machinery. Maybe it's rubbish and maybe they're starting to make good machinery and thought I'd better have a new name and lose our reputation. I don't believe that's the case. I think they've got a good reputation.
No. Yeah, I think I have got a good reputation. But, yeah, it's strange, though. Companies do this from time to time, don't they? I mean, we've discussed one or two others.
Well, often it's because they lose the right to the name. I haven't done my homework here. I don't know what the connection is in terms of ownership between Hitachi Construction Machinery and the, you know, big Hitachi that does all the other stuff. It's possible that it's only partially owned. It may, for all I know, it may not be owned at all by Hitachi, and someone else owns it, and they were given, you know, 10 years or 5 years license to use the name. That's quite a common thing.
I don't think that's the case in this instance. I mean, I did do a quick Wikimedia search on Hitachi, the brand itself, and they, you know, like a lot of these big organizations, they have to. I suppose a massive organisation like one of these Japanese or Korean conglomerates that do everything is that they have, if they were to remain completely cast in stone, then, you know, parts of this business would atrophy and die away. They've got to keep juggling their portfolio in order to keep the core business and their shareholders on the up, as it were. And Hitachi have sold off or partnered with or licensed various parts of their organisation, different businesses over the years. They continue to do it all the time. Hitachi Construction Machinery, I believe, is still wholly owned by Hitachi, the group itself. And so this is just a name change. I don't think it's anything to do with a change of ownership. Or,
well, maybe it's a future change in ownership. Maybe there's something coming down the line that they're looking to get rid of it and they don't want to anyone else have the Hitachi name. So that's, it could be part of that plan. But either way, I mean, we're talking about, you know, drawing attention to yourself, whether it was for, you know, Gilbert Ash or Cement. And this name change is not about them drawing attention to themselves so much. It's interesting. It is a, you know, a marketing story.
Yes.
But the plant manufacturer who's done a very good job at drawing attention to themselves is this company. I suppose everyone says Bocker, but I think it should be Bocker. Because there's an umlaut over the O. It's a German manufacturer. They make aluminium cranes and they make I think they make aerial work platforms, but specifically, well, go on, you tell the story. Why have they been in the news?
If you didn't know who Burka was before last week, then you know about them now. You probably know about them now because one of their products is this thing, what's it called? The Burka Agilo or Agilo, Agilo probably. It's a furniture lift. That's how it's been described in the press anyway, in the national press, international press. It's a furniture lift. It's basically a ladder with a sort of a...
like a fireman's ladder on the back of a truck.
Yeah, that kind of thing. And it's got this sort of powered cradle which goes up and down it. A bit like a mast climber, only inclined, I suppose. Yeah, well, it was used to great effect in the heist on the Louvre Museum in Paris when they villains came along and stole the French crown jewels. They used a Burka Agilo machine to get up to the first floor, actually second floor, I think, in British terms, window, break in and have it away with the crown jewels. It's quite interesting. The Guardian did quite a good report on this. What happened is that Burka became aware of this, obviously, as you would. It was all over the news. And almost immediately, I think within a day, they hurried out this advert on social media with this tagline, "If you're in a hurry, the Burka Agilo carries your treasures up to 400 kilograms at 42 meters a minute, quiet as a whisper, thanks to its 230-volt electric motor." And of course... I think a lot of people basically stood up and applauded Burka for being so quick off the mark and actually capitalising on this unexpected publicity. But the Guardian interviewed or quoted the marketing director of Burka, a woman called Julia Schwarvatz, who is actually the wife of the owner, Alexander Burka. And she said, "It became clear to us, oh my goodness, this is a reprehensible act and we've missed out and they've misused our device to do it." And then she said, "But after it was apparent that no one had been hurt, we started making a few jokes and putting our heads together on slogans we found funny." So
forgive me for interrupting, but they haven't just misused it by committing a crime. People aren't meant to ride up. It's not designed for carrying people.
Well, they've misused it in that respect as well.
You're only supposed to carry...
also stolen it. We ought to point out they'd stolen it.
Well, that as well, yes.
Yeah, okay. I didn't realise that. Yes, I suppose. Yes, the villains were using it to get up there. Yeah, I thought, good for them. Because, I mean, I'd heard of Burka before.
For the villains or for Burka?
No, for Burka, not the villains, of course. I mean, they're terrible, terrible people.
I think they've been caught now, I believe.
Yes. So I hear that. I think they used they had their dabs already on file, so they managed to get them, or it was their DNA or something like that. So, but whether or not they'll get the jewels back, I don't know. They've probably been broken up and sold off to various fences around Europe by now. But it's interesting how something like that. Where you find yourself suddenly thrown into the spotlight, it can, it can obviously be bad publicity, but it can be good publicity. And in this instance, Burka obviously grabbed the opportunity to capitalise on it. But I can remember a very different situation many years ago now. When I edited a Crane magazine, we often mention these Crane magazines, speaking to the marketing people at Grove Cranes, who actually some years before had to fend off some very bad publicity, because this would have been about, I don't know, 6 or 7 years after the Iranian Revolution in 1979, when the Shah of Iran was overthrown and the
Ayatollahs came in.
Yeah, Ayatollahs came in. Well, there was a huge wave of public executions of people who had been associated with the Shah. And all over the world, there were these images of rank upon rank of Grove mobile cranes with people dangling from the hooks being hanged, these public executions. And, there was the Grove logo clearly discernible on the booms of these cranes. And, that was...
A bit harder to cash in on that, isn't it?
Yeah, harder to cash in. And then there was another occasion I remember when, not that much longer ago, only about, well, I think it was in the early 2000s, when a US peace protester in Rafah on the Gaza Strip was crushed to death by a Caterpillar D9 bulldozer.
Yes, I remember that.
Which, an armoured bulldozer used by the IDF, the Israeli Defence Force. Yeah, that again was a lot of very, very bad publicity. And in fact, I have to say, Caterpillar has come in for a lot of stick over the years for...
But it's everywhere. It's a big company, so it's going come to the territory, I guess.
Yeah, but I mean, it's... it does supply the Israeli Defence Force with a lot of its equipment, and they're frequently seen, you know, sort of raising Palestinian homesteads to the ground and stuff like this. It reflects very badly on Caterpillar, but I suppose they're big enough to absorb that sort of publicity from time to time.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think there's obviously a difference between breaking into the Louvre and stealing some diamonds and jewels or whatever, and having your equipment used for public executions. or you know, ploughing down Palestinian homes or whatever, because there's always something slightly, at least in cultural mythology, that people who are stealing money, stealing from art galleries or whatever, while of course they're crooks, they have been the heroes in so many films, Ocean's 11 or whatever.
Yeah.
So it is perfectly possible to portray them as kind of heroic, even though they're not.
Hmm.
But not everyone, not all machinery manufacturers, I think, are happy to see their, or will cash in on seeing their machines used in this way. Because the machine of choice for people who steal cash points seems to be the JCB Lodal, JCB telehandler. And there have been two just in the past fortnight. There's one, or at least two, that I've seen reported. There's one in Horncastle, which is that Lincolnshire? I'm not sure.
Lincolnshire, I believe, yeah.
Yeah, Lincolnshire. And another one in Milton Keynes. Two different, I don't know if it's the same gang, I don't know.
I think it probably is. I think it probably is, because there have been a spate of these attacks. They always use JCB Lodal. Stolen, of course.
And I don't think Anthony Bamford thought, ooh, we should put out an advert saying, if you really want to, get that cash machine out the wall, nothing's quite as strong as a JCB Lodal.
No, quite.
I mean, they absolutely, distance themselves from it. So
the irony is that the national press, the press in general, whenever a digger is in the news, an excavator, any construction equipment, they either call it a bulldozer or a JCB. Whether or not it's a bulldozer or a JCB, it's either one of those things. And on this occasion, it is actually a JCB, though it's not a bulldozer, admittedly. And JCB, obviously, they don't like it when, say, a Caterpillar or a Ford backhoe loader is used for one of these thefts. They always call it a JCB when it's not. It's somebody else's. Well, of course, you'd be upset about that. But
then when something's on tracks, the word Caterpillar tends to get generic.
Yes, that's true.
Because of the Caterpillar tracks.
I hadn't realised, again, just doing a little bit of Googling about this, there's a steady stream of thefts of cash point machines from banks and building societies and
convenience stores. I'm surprised there's any cash point machines left, because who uses no one uses money. There can't be much money in cash machines anymore.
Well, that's a good point, actually, yeah. But, yeah, it happens quite a lot. And as you say, two in 1 week, that's quite remarkable. But more frequent than I had realised, actually. I think maybe a lot of them are only mentioned locally, and local news reports, local press, stuff like that. But there, yeah, you go along, you steal a digger or a bulldozer or a JCB and go and help yourself to some cash. It's obviously a profitable way of getting a bit of money.
The question is, this leads on to our next subject, whether it should be harder to steal one of these machines.
Yeah.
I mean, it ought to be that the only person who could operate the machine is the person who's got the key and the password or whatever, and it'd be quite easy to stop wrong'uns from nicking these machines and using them for nefarious purposes, which brings us up onto our final subject of the day. And again, this is a reprise, how do you pronounce that word?
A return
to something we've talked about probably a couple of years ago, which is the Equipment Theft Prevention Act, which Parliament passed a couple of years ago. Was it last year? 2023, 2023, 2 years
ago.
So this legislation passed 2 years ago, and it was kind of paved the way. It's a private member's bill. It wasn't a government bill, and therefore it was only sort of paving the way. But it gave the Home Office powers to bring in secondary legislation to mandate measures on equipment manufacturers and retailers that would mean that things were had to be tagged, have immobilisers, and all sorts of anti-theft devices. And as I said before, the genesis of this, the I think the MP started off, it had a farming constituency, and a lot of farmers were upset about their, particularly their quad bikes being stolen. Farmers' quad bikes are always stolen. And a lot of the quad bike manufacturers are quite happy about this because they're all insured, and farmers have to buy a new quad bike every 6 months, and it's great for the manufacturers. They rub their hands in glee. But they say, why don't you put immobilised on your quad bikes? It's, well, no one would steal them. We wouldn't sell as many. It's a right old scam. And it's not just the quad bike manufacturers. There are certain construction equipment manufacturers who are quite happy to see their machines being stolen because it just drives up sales. It's a sales tactic. Anyway, we ran a... Actually, I wrote it for you for the magazine that you edited a couple of years ago, on the back of it, explaining that this Equipment Theft Prevention Act may have started for agricultural equipment, specifically quad bikes and all-terrain vehicles. But actually, for as far as the police are concerned and the politicians, it was much more than that. That was just a way to piggyback in construction theft, whether it's tools or plant.
Which makes sense.
Absolutely.
Perfect sense, yeah.
But the government have now responded just a week or two ago, saying that, we're moving forward with the Home Office, with the secondary legislation to require marking, tracking devices for quad bikes and...
use ATVs, all-terrain
vehicles that farmers use. But we're not going to do it for diggers and, construction equipment. We're not going to do it for power tools. And in fact, I'm not even sure that they're mandating immobilisers to... they're not even mobilised for ATVs. It's just tracking devices for tagging for the vehicles and the removable global positioning systems. Yeah. So that's a bit of a move forward, but it's the right cop-out. They're going nowhere near as far as most people wanted them to.
Well, it seems utterly pointless to me. I mean, I know where I live, I see a lot of all-terrain vehicles and quad bikes because I live in generally a rural area and the farmers all have one. But what must be the proportion of... compare the value of total quad bike thefts in the UK with the total value of construction equipment thefts in the UK every year. And I should think that the former probably pales into insignificance. I don't know, how much is a quad bike? A few grand, isn't it? But an excavator or a dumper or something like that, that's going to be tens of thousands of pounds, possibly hundreds of thousands of pounds if it's a big one and a very new one. And they're being stolen all the time. And I think anybody in the industry knows that the theft of tools from vans and that kind of thing is a massive problem as well. So to me, it makes no sense just to limit it to one particular class of equipment and ignore the rest.
I've got some stats for you.
Go on.
In 2022, across England, Wales and Northern Ireland, so not Scotland, don't know why not Scotland, analysis by police force data by Direct Line, 35,000 tool thefts.
Wow.
And elsewhere, further down, this is what I wrote a couple of years ago. Quad bikes, about 800 to 1,100 a year are stolen.
Well, that's a drop in the ocean, isn't it? It's ridiculous.
Now, with the tool theft, I suspect the tool theft is if you have your bag of tools and you've got a spanner, a screwdriver, a power drill, and you've got 12 tools in there, that's probably 12 tools. It depends how you record it. I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah. But either way, tool theft and plant theft is, I think they're more than 800 to 1,100 cases of plant theft in construction sector a year, although
that's
I don't
crazy.
Know that number. Although it's gone down a lot, because and part of the reason why I think the government's relaxed about it is the success of the CESA scheme, which is I can't remember what it stands for, but it's the Construction Equipment Security and Registration Scheme.
Yes, it's probably that, yeah.
And I think they now have an A in it, so it's like Julius Caesar does have.
Oh,
it says
right.
Construction for Agriculture. Construction and Agriculture Equipment Security and Registration Scheme. And it's basically, it's a tagging scheme. There's,
yes.
You pay your money to join a scheme, your machine's tagged. And a lot of the good manufacturers do it at factory level, I think. It comes with a CESA tag embedded in it. It doesn't stop your machine being stolen. They're not necessarily fitting immobilizers, but when your machine is stolen, the police can ring up, DataTag, who are the tracking people, and say, this machine's been stolen, this is its number, and say, right, we can track it, and we can go locate it, and when we find it, we can prove that it's the right one because it's all tagged and whatever. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know how hot the police are. There's all these stories about people having their, whether it's a bicycle or their mobile phones being stolen, and they bring the police up. We don't care about that. And people find out for themselves. And people read a story the other day in the paper about someone who'd accosted a bike thief, and they'd travelled, to the other side of London because they had a little tag on their bike, found it, and said, excuse me, that's my bike you've stolen. And as luck would have it, they said, oh, terribly sorry, there you go. And it all ended quite peacefully. I don't think it always ends quite so.
Why can't you do that with a JCB load all? You could actually locate it before they've stolen the cash point machine.
Good point, but only if you know it's been it's been stolen.
Well, there are systems, aren't there, which are geolocated, so and they'll automatically if they leave a certain geofencing, I think they call
it.
If they leave a certain radius of where it's been left, it automatically sends a signal to your mobile device or what it might be, and alerts you that it's been moved without any authority. I don't see why they can't do that.
I suppose they can
do that, but I mean, maybe people just don't.
My suspicion, I have no knowledge of this, but my suspicion is that your plant hire companies, whose entire revenue stream is derived from the machines and the movement of these machines, are probably much better at using the telematics and the tagging and the geofencing and everything than your farmer who's got a telehandler and it's on his yard all day and it goes from barn to orchard or barn to field or whatever. He's probably not prepared, not interested in paying the extra or the telematics. He just uses it for what he uses it for.
Yeah.
And they're probably the ones which are more prone to being stolen. So my wild guess, not so wild guess, is that the load-alls that are being used for stealing ATMs have been stolen from farms rather than construction. But I may be wrong about that.
You're just trying to shift the blame, Phil.
Oh, yeah.
No, but you might be right. You might be right. Yeah, I mean, it's probably easier to steal it from a farm, probably easier to get onto a farm and get away without being seen. They tend to be remote, don't they?
Yeah, but they've got dogs.
Yeah, that's right. And shotguns.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's it's always a problem. It's always an issue, plant theft and all the crimes which are committed subsequent to plant theft. So.
Yeah, I think it's a big shame the Home Office, they have published their reason for it. They just basically said, oh, it's all too difficult, it's too complicated. And I think the government got enough on their plates without trying to up.
Yeah.
But it's a shame.
It is. I mean, it's interesting that the police superintendent, Andrew Huddleston, who I think you might have interviewed actually for the feature you wrote for us, said at the time, he said the bill is absolutely targeting, this is when it was a bill, not an act, is absolutely targeting the construction industry, period. So, I mean, the intention was there.
But when the Home Office launched their follow-up consultation to say, right, what are we going to do about this secondary legislation? It only talked about quad bikes. It didn't even talk about, construction machinery. It mentioned a little bit in passing farmers' tools, but it's all very much an agricultural. So I think the Home Office from day one, I think, were trying to sweep the whole construction thing under the table and let construction sort its own mess out with CESA.
Yeah.
And the legislation wouldn't have mandated CESA. It would have said you have to do something like CESA. But given that CESA already exists and is, I don't know what percentage, but so dominant, it would have effectively made CESA the go-to system that would be mandated.
Yeah. Well, I suppose if you're the owner of the equipment and you're keen not to have it stolen, then the remedy is there. You can do it yourself, can't you? It's persuading the manufacturers to build it into their products, I suppose. Well,
they should build immobilizer. Why they don't have immobilizers built in? I mean, that's a sensible thing. It's a little keypad for your starter number or whatever. I mean,
yeah.
These quad bikes, every, I don't know the manufacturers, but this is what I was told by Trevor Huddleston when I was doing research in this piece a couple of years ago, the copper who's big noise in the whole plant theft world, that there are makes of quad bike which are, you know, popular amongst farmers because they're cheap and readily available and they work, that the same key opens all of them. It's a bit like I think the first briefcase I had as a schoolboy or satchel or something had a little lock on it which you could open with anyone could open with a little paperclip. It was barely a key at all.
And I suppose also maybe with a quad bike, if you've got a small flatbed van or something like that, or you've got a van with some ramps at the back, you can just wheel it up into the back of the van and have away with it, can't you? You don't have to get in and drive it away. You can just pick it up and take it.
True, but I think you can buy the keys on eBay for nothing and go off and walk off and... Yeah, I mean...
And just help yourself.
Yeah. Any other business? What else do you want to talk about?
I don't know. Is there anything else to talk about? That seems to have covered it.
Right, well, we'll be back again in 2 weeks' time, folks. By which time it'll be in November. Good gracious, where's the year going? But for another episode of Reconstruction, thank you very much for listening. And from David and I, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.